listening to The Radiator, 105.9 FM, WOMMLP, Burlington, Vermont. I'm Shayla Shapiro, and this is Write the Book, the show for writers and curious readers. Write the Book features interviews with authors, poets, illustrators, agents, and editors. Today on Write the Book, you'll hear an interview with Thomas Christopher Green, Vermont novelist and president of the Vermont College of Fine Arts. His new book is The Headmaster's Wife. Thomas Christopher Green was born and raised in Worcester, Massachusetts. He has worked in a staple factory, as an oyster shucker, a speechwriter, and a spokesperson for a presidential campaign, the director of public affairs for two colleges, and as a professor of writing and literature. In 2006, Tom founded the Vermont College of Fine Arts, a top New England arts college, making him the youngest college president in America at that time. The Headmaster's Wife is Tom's fourth novel. Published by Thomas Dunn Books, The Headmaster's Wife is a haunting and deeply affecting portrait of one couple at their best and worst. Inspired by a personal loss, Green explores the way that tragedy and time assail one man's memories of his life and loves. Like his father before him, Arthur Winthrop is the headmaster of Vermont's elite Lancaster School. It is the place he feels has given him his life, but is also the site of his undoing as events spiral out of his control. Found wandering naked in Central Park, he begins to tell his story to the police, but his memories collide into one another, and what emerges is a narrative of love, marriage, family, and tragedy, a tragedy Arthur does not know how to address. Luminous and atmospheric, bringing to life the tight-knit enclave of a quintessential New England boarding school, the novel is part mystery, part love story, and an exploration of the ties of place and family. When I spoke with Thomas Christopher Green in January, I asked him to talk about his daughter Jane, to whose brief life he attributes his inspiration for the way he wrote this book.
Well, our daughter Jane, our second daughter, was born far too early. She was born at 27 weeks gestation. Mm. In some ways, she was a miracle. She was 1 pound, 14 ounces. Didn't look like she was going to make it through the first few minutes of life. Didn't look like she was going to make it through the first day. And she was an amazingly spirited little baby. And she lived for 6 months. Mm. Never left the hospital. And spent five of those months at Dartmouth Hitchcock, 1 month at Children's Hospital in Boston. It was a very heady time for my wife and I. We had we have a three-year-old daughter at the time, who's now seven. And I was working on starting Vermont College of Fine Arts. So things were busy, and plus I was trying to work on writing a novel. And I was trying to write a very different novel, but, you know, I think the lesson of Jane for me was to be fearless and to be honest and to pour myself into the work. And I had, when I was there, you know, a lot of the times when she was sleeping, you know, I had time to work. And the NICU was a surprisingly good place to work. It's very noisy. There's a lot of studies that show that people who actually spend as much as a week in the NICU end up with some kind of PTSD. Mm. And we were there for 6 months, which is an extraordinary amount of time. And it was a very challenging period in our life, but it was also a time of amazing joy, which is kind of amazing. And the reason I put it in the acknowledgments and dedicated the book to her was because of both of what she taught me, but also that the people who were around us in that time, in particular the nurses who work in the NICU, who are incredibly giving, selfless people, amazing human beings, made a big difference in our lives. And this book is in some ways a way of telling Jane's story without telling it. Mm-hmm. Because it is, you know, it is in some ways a novel of grief. And the characters in this book are not myself or my wife. And the child in question is certainly not Jane, as a 20-year-old boy. But, you know, the universality of grief, I think, comes through the narrative, and I was able to really write from that in some ways from a personal point of view.
Okay, all right. Now, the main character in the novel, at the beginning of the novel, is Arthur, and he's the narrator, and he is the school's headmaster.
Yes.
So that's interesting, because you're the president of the school.
Right.
And did you start with that narrator because you were in the thick of starting the Vermont College of Fine Arts?
Yeah. Well, I mean, I think there's commonalities there. You know, yes, I mean, the conclusion would be, how autobiographical is it? Because Arthur is the headmaster of fictitious boarding school, Lancaster School in Vermont. I'm the president of a college in Vermont. I'm also someone who went to boarding school, surprisingly. I was, you know, everyone in my family had, I grew up in sort of middle-class family in Worcester, Massachusetts. Everybody went through public schools. When I was around 16 years old, I think my parents were trying to figure out why this ostensibly intelligent child was not doing very well, and they brought me to somebody who suggested I go to a boarding school and see if that helped. So I was a bit of a fish out of water there, so I was able to really see that world through a writer's eyes. And I'd always wanted to set a novel there, and this seemed like an opportunity to do that.
Okay. I was just going to read a paragraph. Early in the novel, there's a moment where the narrator, Arthur, this headmaster, is touring the school's sporting events, and he says, "Everyone is happy to see me, or pretends to be. Whatever they think of me personally, they respect the office. That is one thing I have learned. Like it or not, I am the face of Lancaster, and they are suitably pleased that I have graced their particular game with my presence, which is entirely the point." And I loved that. And
yeah.
It's funny, because I don't know that I spend a lot of time thinking about the perspective of the leader of a school, you know.
Right.
It is it's a unique position, and it's in, and it crosses over with teaching, because some of Arthur's duties are to teach.
Right.
But it's administrative, and it's different, and mm-hmm. it is the face of the school.
Well, I mean, I think for me personally, that's something I've had to learn to deal with. You know, when I led the effort to start Vermont College of Fine Arts, I never intended to be the president. My goal was to really do a community effort on behalf of all my friends here on the faculty and staff, and I'd come out of higher ed administration. And I come from a higher education family. My father's a college president. My brother, you know, is a new president of Colby College. And so the last thing I ever wanted to be in some ways was a college president. But as we got through that process, in order to become an independent college, it became pretty clear, both from the people who are going to finance it and from the accrediting agencies who are going to say, you have permission to grant degrees and be a college, that I didn't have much of a choice, so they weren't going to do it if I wasn't the president. And I've had to sort of learn to adjust to that role and what it means. And often it means that people expect you to speak whenever you walk into a room, which has been a real shift for me, because, you know, I'm both an introvert and an extrovert. I'm fine with doing the public side of it, but it's also been an adjustment to learn that people do have that perspective on the office itself and the person who holds it, and so I think I was able to kind of channel that through Arthur in this book.
Yeah. The great thing about Arthur as a narrator is that, to some extent, because he is the head of the school, all eyes are on him.
Mm-hmm.
And yet, within his narrative world, he's misbehaving rather badly.
He is.
Okay. So Arthur begins an affair with a student named Betsy Pappas. And from the beginning, there's this sense that something's just a little bit off about his attraction to Betsy. I don't want to give anything away, but I want to talk about writing this so that readers pick up on that sense of something being a little
yes.
bit off, but not giving everything away. And in order to have this affair, because he's the head of the school, Arthur has to believe he's throwing everything away. So I wonder how you approached the task of setting the tone of this novel so that we see what Arthur's going through and that we know there's something a little bit off, but we can't put our finger on it.
I really like books where the reader sometimes knows more than the narrator knows himself.
Mm-hmm.
And I think that's part of what happens here with Arthur. Arthur has such a carefully constructed facade, as a lot of us do, but as someone particularly who is head of a boarding school, whose father was the headmaster of the boarding school before him, and his grandfather before that, he was born to this job, this life, and with that becomes, you know, comes a lot of trappings around it. And so he's carefully constructed his entire life, and it's beginning to dissolve in front of him. Mm-hmm. And we know that in a way that he does not reading it.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. And if we know a little bit about what's been going on in his life. We have some of the facts
mm-hmm.
About his son who went to war. But it doesn't overwhelm the narrative. It's just something that the reader knows about, which I thought was the right way to go about sharing
right.
Arthur's information.
Well, and you also know something's amiss because the novel opens with Arthur being arrested for wandering naked through Central Park.
Right.
And then he begins to tell his story to the police, the story of this affair with Betsy Pappas. And as a reader, you're hearing that, and I hope you're intrigued by it, but at the same time, you're probably questioning some of the premises.
Yeah.
Underlying what he's actually saying.
Right, right. I wanted to ask you a little bit about the pacing of the novel. The novel moves really well, and I think part of it has to do with these short chapters that you've written. They're like punchy moments of narrative, and then we're on to the next thing. So I wonder, was that a conscious decision, or was that just sort of how the book evolved as you worked?
It was a conscious decision. It was actually something I did in my last novel too, Envious Moon. And part of it is the way a book looks to me.
Mm-hmm.
You know, the chapter is somewhat of an artifice within a novel, which is an artifice in itself. But what I have done is taken away chapter headings. You know, there's no chapter one, chapter two, there's no titles to chapters. And so whenever I hit what would be a natural sort of page break or a little white space in between a new paragraph, I just made it a new chapter.
Mm-hmm.
And I think that's structurally that's allowed me a lot of freedom, but I think it does create a page turner.
Yeah.
It creates a book that makes it harder to put down.
Right.
So that's how I structured it and how I chose to do it.
Apart from what's appropriate for the narrative, and mm-hmm. I do think that is appropriate because there's a lot that we can move through quickly that's going on for Arthur. But also I think readers, you know, sometimes they'll sink into a long chapter and then that breaking point is where they stand up and walk away, you know.
Right.
That's not going to happen here because there's the next one and it's only going to take a few minutes and I'm at a good point and I want to know what happens.
Well, I mean, a lot of commercial fiction does this, you know, James Patterson's The World, you know, they'll have books with 280 chapters in them or something like that, and it does encourage that page-turning sense.
Yeah.
It's unusual doing literary novels, but, yeah.
Right, and how would you label this genre? Is it sort of literary, psychological?
Yeah, I don't know. I mean, I think it's literary fiction. It's a book that I think probably has a lot of crossover appeal, though, to other people because it is both a psychological novel, it's somewhat of a mystery.
Mm-hmm.
It's a novel that has its share of surprises and twists in the plot. But it's one that has the elements of literature, both with the strength of the voice and I think what I hope is really lapidary prose and the way that that's created.
Definitely. And also a sort of unusual structure that serves it well, but isn't what you'd see in, I think, most commercial fiction. Which
that's right. It's different, yeah.
Yeah. Well, before we talk about the structure, which I do want to get to, I wonder if you wouldn't mind reading from the book.
Sure.
Okay.
I guess I'm going to read from near the opening, which is, this is when Arthur begins to tell his story to the police. It starts with the most innocent of gestures. She does something girls the world over do. She uses her long fingers to pull strands of straw-colored hair behind her ears. She is leaning over her book at her desk in the front row. I have not noticed her before, though it is only the second day since I've returned to the classroom. She is rather unremarkable. Maybe I passed her on the walks around campus, but I don't remember seeing her before. She looks up. She is pretty, but in a sad-eyed Slavic kind of way. Her face slightly off-center, green eyes with small bags under them that will only grow with age. Her skin clear and pink. I get lost looking at her. I forget for a moment the rest of the class, and when she turns her gaze away from the blackboard behind me to my face, I become aware of all the eyes on me. Time to speak. I look over their heads and find my voice. It was the chair of the board's idea that I stepped back into the classroom. At first, the suggestion angered me, especially how it was framed. "You seem distracted, Arthur," Dick Ives said to me after the last board meeting. "Just didn't bring my A game, Dick," I said. "It's not just that," said Dick, "more of a general feeling the board has. This isn't about golf again, is it? It is well known that I hate golf. It is a silly game, hitting a tiny ball with a stick for hours on end, and the board has been after me to do more of it, that donors expect it. For the life of me, I've never been able to figure out what golf has to do with education at the Lancaster School." "God, no," Dick said. "It might benefit you to get back to your first love, dip your toe in, get closer to the mission. The capital campaign is done. Couldn't be a better time." And so in the fall, I returned to my old discipline, English, by teaching one class. I choose the Russians. I always loved the Russians. Pushkin and Lermontov, Gogol, Turgenev and Chekhov, Dostoevsky and the great Tolstoy. The atmosphere, the ethos of their work. They remind me of Vermont in November. Dark moors and muted colors. Landscapes awash in brown. Lives determined by birthright and accidents of fate. Anyway, immediately I see the wisdom of Dick's advice. Standing in the classroom with the fall sun streaming through the windows, looking out over my charges, hearing the rise and fall of my voice, it is like I am transported back in time. I am 24 again, a year removed from Yale, in the classroom where I belong. Literature matters. Literature is important.
This, I think, is why you raise money, why you build buildings, why you endure endless bus travel over these hills for Wednesday and Saturday sporting events. Because in few corners of the world can you find the deeper human truths still being taught as they should be, the kind of truths that mold minds and create leaders. Lancaster has yet to produce a president, though it has come close. Perhaps in this room in front of me, I imagine, sits one of them. I turn my attention back to the classroom, handsome preppy teenagers, the lot of them, the chosen ones. I pose a question and it pleases me. The way it is constructed, grand enough to be rhetorical, but also grounded. I look around. A few hands go up. I look over at her. Her hand is raised. She looks confident. Something about her speaks to me, and I cannot figure out what. I call on her, and I don't fully hear what she says, though she has a nice voice. Instead, I am fixated on her face, as if somewhere in those sad eyes resides a clue as to why her pulling her hair behind her ears has made me notice her in a way that tells me that it has been a long time since I have noticed anything at all.
Great. Thank you for reading that.
You're welcome.
Do you ever think about getting into teaching here?
I've done a little teaching here.
Oh, you have?
Yeah, I've done a little teaching at the college. Last summer I led a novel workshop.
Oh, okay.
And
I
taught.
Is that the postgraduate?
No, actually in the MFA in writing program.
Oh, okay.
With Connie Mae Fowler and I did a workshop together.
Oh,
for people who are just working on novels. And it was good. I mean, in some ways it made me think of that scene, but it was good to teach. It was good to get closer to the mission. The Capitol campaign was not done, unlike Arthur's. We're still working on that. But it was it was a great experience. Great experience to read student work and be part of that. And I think someday I'll teach again. You know, I'll go back, and when my president days are over, I'll probably do some teaching.
So is that a term? Do you know what your term is as president? Or
No, I serve at the pleasure of the Board of Trustees.
Okay.
And so we don't have term limits.
Yeah.
You know, I've been doing it now for 7 years.
Okay.
And you know, I'm still having fun, and as long as I'm having fun, I'm going to keep doing it.
Well, what surprises me, I'm actually going out of order for my questions, but
sure,
since we're talking about it, it surprises me that you're able to write as much as you are. You've written 5 books in how many years?
This is my 4th novel.
4. Oh, okay.
But I consider the college a novel too, so we'll call it 5.
Okay.
College, like a 4th novel.
I saw 5 on.
There's a British version of my 2nd novel, I'll Never Be Long Gone. There's a different title people often buy and think it's a different novel, and then I get angry letters from readers who say, hey, this is the same novel I already bought with a different title. And it's not my fault. It was just published in the UK under a different name.
Oh, okay. Still, that's a lot. 4 books.
It is a lot. Well, before this, I was writing full-time. And I will say it slowed down. I mean, I haven't published a novel since 2007. So, you know, the work does take away from the writing time. I was publishing every 2 years.
Yeah.
You know,
yeah.
I published a novel in 2003, 2005, and 2007. And now it's 2014, and the 4th one's coming out.
Okay. All right. I wanted to get back into the writing craft, and something that I noticed when I was reading this. Do you mind if I just read a really quick thing?
No, not at all.
This is so tiny. It really stood out for me. He goes to visit his father at one point, and there's just this wonderful quick snapshot of his father, who's this character that we don't really see a lot of during the novel, but it paints such a full picture, these couple paragraphs. This is from the book. He walks with a cane now, and his silver hair is thinner than it used to be, and he has stooped from age. But even not expecting visitors on some random Wednesday night in November, he is put together as if the board itself might show up at the door. His clothes are pressed as always, a crease down the center of each leg of his tan chinos, his gig line perfect, buttons lined with buttons. He leads me into his study where he has a fire going. My father insists on fires most of the year, even in June. The room is overheated, though my father does not notice. He wears a sweater under his blue sport coat. Scotch, he says. I'll just stop there.
Yeah.
It's this wonderful scene, and you know, the fact that he inherited this position in a way, I mean,
yes,
he's kind of a legacy, you know, in his family, because so many of them have been headmasters, means that his father's presence is always there.
Mm-hmm.
But we meet him in the scene, and I really enjoyed that.
No, thank you. It captures the old man pretty well.
It does.
Yeah.
And I wonder if you can talk about why you think we can learn about that character so quickly in that one little bit.
Well, because I think what I'm doing there is I'm using description as a way of illuminating a broader character. I mean, it says something about somebody who's put together the way he is.
Yeah.
On just a random Tuesday morning when he's retired. Most of us aren't like that. So it says something about the importance of appearance,
mm-hmm.
the importance of propriety, the importance of the position even though he no longer holds it.
Yeah.
The idea of the fire year-round, I think I probably stole that actually from a John McPhee book called The Headmaster, which is about the headmaster of Deerfield School.
Oh, okay.
In the 1960s, a book he wrote, and he talks about how there was always a fire in the headmaster's house no matter what time of year, and I just like that detail so much.
Yeah, well, it is. I love that detail, too, because I think it also shows him as he's not going to change his own rules for anybody else. You know, it seems like this is how he does things,
and there's a way to live, and this is it, and that's part of the ethos of how he does it.
Right. There was another moment in the book that reminded me of this whole thing that we're talking about now. To some extent, I think being able to deliver something in a short space about a character, it is a little bit about appearance and some aspect of appearance mirroring personality.
Mm-hmm.
And so there's this time much later in the book. A man from Arthur's past, who he has misremembered, is wearing a suit that does not quite fit him.
Mm.
And it was a great moment because I didn't think that necessarily spoke so much about the man as it did about Arthur's state of mind in this moment and his trying to place this person, and the suit doesn't quite fit him. And,
yes.
And, you know, neither does the memory of who this is or
oh, that's interesting, yeah.
Yeah, I thought that was great.
Perception.
Do you write more of these sorts of details in a revision or in a first draft, do you think?
Usually that's in a first draft.
Okay.
I mean, I think revisions go, enrich it. I struggled with getting this book started, and I did it a number of different ways, and I finally settled on the structure that exists now. But, the language itself mostly comes through the first draft. And then, in some cases, I punch it up in a revision or I change things to make things work a little better. But more of my revisions are less around detail and more around character
mm-hmm.
and events.
And so you said, you were for a while producing a novel every 2 years.
Right.
Not talking specifically about length of time, but I'm wondering how much of a period of time when you're writing a novel is devoted to the first draft versus the revision? Do you think that you're spending more time on the first draft and then the revision is sort of punch it up? Or
yeah, I think, well, I spend a lot of time getting the first draft right. I end up writing the first 80 pages probably 6 or 7 times.
Okay.
And part of it is I've compared it before to calibrating a key in a lock, and it's usually a little off until I get it right, because you have to have that voice and that sort of narrative stance, if you will, the position you're standing in as you're telling the story that's going to carry it through the full arc of the story.
Right.
And finding that for me is a process of trial and error, and I keep doing it. But once I get it, I know it, and then the rest of the book becomes really a joy to write.
Mm-hmm.
And then the revision really is just improving it after that.
Okay. So everything is not always what it seems in this novel.
Right.
And I'm wondering how difficult is it from the point of view of the writer to create this world, create Arthur's world, create his wife Elizabeth's world, and not have us know too much information too early, but sort of gradually release information that
mm-hmm.
we need to know.
Well, I think that's a challenge. I think it was a challenge with this book to get that just right. That's a place where I did go back and do some revision to try to make that work and hold together. And Elizabeth really doesn't appear a whole lot in the first half of the book, although she is the main character in the second half of
right,
the book.
Right, it's interesting. And I think she's sort of this...
she's almost ghostly.
Ghostly presence.
Yeah,
right.
I think at one point even he says that we move around the house like ghosts,
yeah.
Or we've been moving around the house like ghosts.
Yeah.
But she, so I think that is a challenge on... You have to give people enough information to keep them engaged and know what's happening. At the same time, I save a few things in here
yeah.
that get revealed later that I think, make the book really hold together and work.
Right, but nothing that you've saved feels like you're cheating. You know what I mean? Sometimes there will be twists at the end that say,
Right, the O. Henry
aha,
twist.
She was
yeah.
my sister all along.
Right, right.
I never felt that way with this book. I feel like with this book I knew early on that I was free to come up with hypotheses about what was going on as a reader, and that eventually I would understand.
Yeah, I think I did certain things with Arthur's narrative in the beginning that give you the sense that he's not exactly standing on solid ground.
Right.
And that allows you to sort of look around what he's saying. And like I said before, I mean, I think the idea that the reader knows more than he does is very interesting to me. That's always intrigued me as a writer, to try to do that. And looking at other examples of books that do that well is fascinating.
Right, yeah. Did you know the whole plot of the novel from early on? Once you figured out what the story was, did you know where it was going?
Not entirely in this case. I had a pretty good sense of what I was trying to do, and then I backed up from there. I write towards plot points, so I write towards specific ideas, and knowing that this event is going to happen probably two-thirds of the way through the novel, and it's a critical event in the book. In this case, I knew that the critical event in the book had already happened on some level, and I just didn't know where I was going to position it. And I came up with the idea of the structure and the way it's put together after the fact rather than before, which was different for me. But generally, I write towards plot points. I know how it's going to go. I never outline. I don't do anything that specific. Mm-hmm. And I often find surprises along the way. And in this case, you know, I ended up doing things that I hadn't anticipated doing.
Okay. Which is fun for the reader, too, because if it's a surprise to you, then it's more of a surprise to the reader, I think.
I think so, because that comes through. You can't really hide that.
Although I was shocked when I interviewed Ann Patchett a few weeks ago.
Yeah.
She outlines everything.
She does.
Well, I don't know if it's an outline. She plans it all out. She knows what she's doing. Yeah. So, and she said there's no right or wrong way. And I thought, well, apparently not, since you're doing just...
Everybody's different. It's true.
Okay, water is very important in the book.
Yes.
The school, Lancaster, is on a river. And throughout the book, you weave in these references to water. Some are not at all important. Like, at one point, somebody says something is water under the bridge. And, you know, it's just this throwaway line. But other moments, the water is brought in as a stronger metaphor. One that I particularly like involved a man who was crying, and he's described as sobbing around the burble of the flowing river.
Interesting.
Yeah. I loved that. And just a lot of the water references felt, if not momentously important to the plot, just sort of important to the state of mind of the reader and, you know, and the narrative world. So I'm wondering if you saw water as a symbol throughout, and if so, why do you suppose that helps or pleases the reader or serves the book?
Well, I think rivers are a big theme in the book. I mean, the school is next to the river. At one point in New York, the Hudson River plays sort of a role in the book, and I think it's described as timeless and uncaring. You know, the idea that rivers have been here before we were, and they'll be here probably after, that they go places, but we don't really know where. I've always found great beauty in rivers. It's probably my favorite body of water on some level, because it's the one body of water that seems to move in a clear direction, unlike an ocean or a sea. Which just kind of appears to sit, and I love the ocean, but, you know, rivers, I think, tell a story, and they go places. And so I think rivers are very important, water's very important. Elizabeth is petrified of water, the headmaster's wife in this book, and as you find out, for good reason.
Yeah. Oh, this was great. At one moment, writing from the perspective of a woman, Elizabeth, right? You mentioned that her husband invariably, this is a quote, invariably commits the one mistake he will compound throughout their lives, a failure to leave her alone. If he just let her be sad, just let her dwell in it for a moment, she would come out the other side and be fine. But he is a man and he wants to fix her. She tells him not to, and she tells him he cannot, but he doesn't stop. So I have to say, this moment really impressed me. Because when I'm reading a book by a woman, and that woman paints a man very well, I'm always impressed. And when I'm reading a book by a man, and a man paints a woman's perspective very well, I'm maybe even more impressed.
Thank you. So I got that one right.
You got it right. I'm like, that was just, it was perfect. It was something that made me believe in this character, that there was this dynamic. Because I think that's true for a lot of women, and I think a lot of men want to fix things instead of necessarily just listening or being there.
Right.
Sorry, I'm being sexist. But
I think there's a truth to that. I mean, I think there are differences in genders, and I think it is a challenge to write from the perspective of a woman for a male author. Probably actually more so than it is for a woman to write from the perspective of a man, I think. And part of that is the readers themselves, who are much more likely to be women. For me as a writer, I spend a lot of time just in regular life listening, thinking, talking to people, listening to what they say. I try to really listen, and I try to hear, and I try to observe. And I think those are the most important skills you can have as a writer. And I have a lot of great friends that are women. I'm married to one, and so I think some of that comes through in this book, or I hope it does, and that Elizabeth becomes a very real character because of that.
Yeah. I wanted to just read another little bit, if that's okay.
Sure.
Another little paragraph. This moment follows a sex scene. It's actually the first time that this young woman has had sex. He rolls onto his back. They are side by side, staring at the ceiling. He is breathing hard, and she thinks about this, that he has just done something like work. What has she done? Outside, the sounds of the city move to the foreground, the scream of cars and the cries of a siren, voices that drift up into the fallen night. I just thought this was a lovely moment. I think that it's one mistake that writers sometimes make is forgetting to let the world exist outside of a narrative moment.
Right.
And I just thought it was beautiful how you transitioned from this scene, this very intense scene, and then into the sounds of the city and the world around them in that moment.
Well, and I think it's also, in some ways, that is sort of the heart of perception, the way things are working, because she's been in this sexual moment where those sounds of the city had kind of disappeared.
Mm-hmm.
You know, as two people disappear into each other, and then suddenly the world reemerges
right.
with all its reality, and has she changed or not, or are things just the same as they were the 6 or 7 minutes before, or however long the time was.
Right.
They're teenagers.
Yeah, they're teenagers. He didn't have a lot of experience.
No.
Okay, let's see. So how has I had thought this was your fifth novel. This is your fourth novel.
It is,
and you've published with a different house each time.
I have.
Is that correct?
Yeah.
Not
quite true, because two of the books were with William Morrow HarperCollins. This is my third publisher for four books. Yes, that's a lot.
Okay, and how has your publishing experience been with?
This is St. Martin's Press, Thomas Dunn Books.
Thomas Dunn Books, right.
Yep, part of imprint of St. Martin's Press. This has been the best publishing experience I've had.
Uh-huh.
I think this is the best book I've had, too, and I think that makes a difference. But there's been tremendous enthusiasm in the house, and they're publishing as a lead title, and there's a lot of support and a lot of interest. And publishing is a funny business, I have in some ways been snake bitten, and in other ways I've had tremendous success. It's hard to complain. I mean, my first novel was bought by Michael Kort at Simon & Schuster, who was a bit of a publishing legend, but he retired shortly after. So, I was, quote, orphaned at the house without an editor anymore, mm-hmm. and that was partially why we moved. A similar thing happened to me at HarperCollins, where a prominent editor who bought my book there left the house. And so I've jumped around a lot. I'm feeling really happy about where I am now, and I'm actually feeling pretty optimistic about where publishing is, which I don't know that I would have said 2 or 3 years ago.
Oh, okay. Why is that? Why are you happy?
Well, I think there was a lot of rumors about the death of publishing, that it was... Mm-hmm. Going to go the way of the record industry, for instance, and the rise of electronic books. And what we've actually seen is electronic books have leveled off.
Yeah.
You know, they're around 15% of the market, and that's where they seem to be staying.
Yeah.
People like a book.
Yeah.
You know, I mean, I was worried that I wouldn't be interested in writing as much just for electronic books. And I know that sounds kind of silly because the story is a story. But for me, I really like the production of a physical book. I like to hold it. I like to have them on my shelves. And I think there is really better literature being published right now than any time in our history.
Mm-hmm.
And there are more people writing, and we see it at Vermont College of Fine Arts. There are, right now as we're talking, there's 130 students downstairs here in workshops, and they're remarkable writers from all around the country and all around the world who want to do this, who
yeah.
want to write books, and that's just thrilling.
It is, yeah, it's very exciting. What are you working on now?
I am working on the beginning of a new novel, and it's going very, very slowly.
Okay. Well, you've got the college.
Yeah,
right now we're
college,
during the residency. You're
we're
about to go
residency.
On some sort of a book tour, I assume.
I will be doing some traveling for the book. I'm also, you know, doing, I'm running a college, and that's busy. But I'm running a very interesting novel. It's also from the point of view of a woman who's a psychiatrist and it goes through some real challenges in her life and her marriage and trying to figure things out.
Hmm.
Yeah, woman's midlife crisis. I don't know why that interests me, but I'm writing it.
All right, and I was wondering, what are you reading these days, or who are some of your favorite writers?
Well, I just finished Goldfinch.
Oh, me too.
Donna Tartt's book.
I have like 20 pages left.
Well, you have 20 pages left. I will tell you, you have something incredible to look forward to, because I think the last dozen pages of that book may be the most exquisite writing I've ever read.
Okay.
It just is glorious. I think she's a fabulous writer.
She's
I think it's
amazing.
A great book. I'm a big fan of Ann Patchett, who's been on your show. I think her work right now is amazing. I'm reading a Claire Massoud book right now.
The Woman Upstairs?
Yes.
I love
about halfway through that, which I think is fabulous. I'm a big fan of Cormac McCarthy. You know, when he publishes a book, I run out and get it. But there's so many great writers. E.L. Doctorow, I like a lot of his work. I just think there's so many. Scott Spencer. A lot of fabulous writers out there.
Will you pull certain books off the shelf to read to yourself when you're writing?
I do. I look at models.
Yeah.
You know, when my first book sold, it was really funny because, you know, I was trying to get an agent, and I had sent out the book to agents, and I got a call at 11 o'clock on a Friday night from a woman working for a very prominent New York agent, and she said, "I'm reading your book right now, and I just had to call you and tell you I absolutely love it, and it reminds me of The Great Gatsby." And what I didn't tell her was, well, I'd basically stolen the first 20-page structure of that book, you know, in terms of, you know, it was my own work, but in terms of how Fitzgerald structured the opening of that book, I did the exact same thing. And so I often look at that for examples, and I think it really helps to be reading a lot if you're trying to write.
Okay, great. So you just mentioned structure, and actually my last question for you is about structure. This book is split into two main narratives. There's actually a little third part, too. It's kind of like a part one, part two, and then a little part three.
Yes.
Each is delivered from a separate point of view.
Yes.
And then the third section from a third point of view. So it sounds like you had to work to find this structure, and it helped you with the release of the information.
It's an unconventional narrative. It's almost a bifurcated narrative, if you will.
Right.
And I think it really, really serves this book. It was funny when my agent went out to try to publish it. It was a concern for a few publishers. Like, well, I don't know. Readers aren't used to this kind of thing. It's different. And people are so focused on what the market is and whether it will work. But I think what we're discovering now with the advanced readers reviews that are coming out and the reviews that are coming out from the trade publications that are incredibly positive about this book, that it's just a non-issue. And I think makes it a very distinctive novel because it hasn't been done for a while. I mean, one model I looked at where it was done was John Fowles, who is a great writer who isn't probably read as much now as he...
The Magus.
Yeah, The Magus, and his first novel, The Collector.
The Collector, beautiful
was novel. Was split in half.
Was two, it? Okay.
It was split in half. It was a...
Two women, or was it the
no,
man
it was,
and
it was,
one
it
of
was
the women?
A, it was a, that's a novel about a man who abducts a woman, and
right.
The first half of the novel is from his point of view, and the second half is from hers,
right?
Which in some ways is very similar to how The Headmaster's Wife is structured.
There's also a book by Michael Cunningham. I think it was the book he put out before The Hours that did the same thing.
Is that right?
I think so. It's
his work is also someone who's a model for me, and I had a chance to bother him recently in a New Haven bar, which was very funny because I had sent him actually this book hoping he would write a blurb for it, and I happened to be passing through New Haven on a fundraising trip for the college on my way back, and happened to walk into the hotel bar around midnight, and there's Michael Cunningham, and we had some correspondence, and I went up to him, and I swear he thought I was stalking him, which wasn't the case. We had a great conversation though.
That's good. That's nice. I think that if there's any risk to this kind of structure, it's that the reader will feel attached to the first narrator and not want to let go. And for me, I just felt like I had so many questions about Arthur's narrative that I was excited to find the answers through the next narrator.
Right.
So I thought that sort of set aside whatever risk there might have been.
I mean, I think that was a real challenge in structuring it this way, is because it is asking a lot of the reader, because they get used to a voice, they get used to an idea. But I think what we're finding is that people are willing to take that leap for that same reason you just articulated. They want to. People read often to find out, and this is a book where you want to find out, because there are big questions that are raised as it goes along, and they get answered.
Yeah, they do. So, do you have any advice for writers who are struggling to find the right structure for their novels? Not necessarily that they would emulate this particular structure,
yes.
but how do you find the right structure?
Well, I think look at models, look at other books, read a lot. Write your way through it. I mean, begin to write. I think the most important advice I can give writers is to read a ton, which everybody gives to me, to be thick-skinned, which I think is a really important virtue in a writer, because you have to trust your own vision on some level, and know that when you put your work out publicly, it's both an act of courage, but one that people will respond to in different ways that you can't control.
Yeah.
But when it comes to structure, I would look at novels you love and read them not as a reader, but read them as a writer, and try to break it down just as you try to break down, if you're into cooking, the way a great chef has constructed a dish.
Mm-hmm.
Try to figure out what the ingredients are in it, how it works, pull them out, start at the beginning, see how it was assembled, and then see if you can do the same thing yourself. Don't be afraid to mimic, don't be afraid to copy.
Structure.
Yeah, not words. Not words or language. You got to do that yourself, or story, but structure.
Okay, that's great advice. Thank you very much for speaking with me.
It was my pleasure. Thank you for having me.
I hope you enjoyed that conversation with Thomas Christopher Green. You can learn more about his work at his website, thomaschristophergreen.com, and that's Green with an E at the end. Write the Book and the Radiator are supported in part by Battery Street Jeans, where vintage and recycled clothing come together through love. Happy days. Located at 7 Marble Avenue, the south end of Burlington. For more information, check out batterystreetjeans.com. And by Burlington Telecom, providing Burlington with access to the world. Internet, television, telephone. BurlingtonTelecom.com, Burlington's fiber optic network. This week's Write the Book prompt was inspired by the interview you heard today with Thomas Christopher Green. Write a scene from the perspective of a narrator who does not understand what is happening, but write it so that the reader does understand. Good luck with this exercise, and please listen next week for another. If you're interested in sharing this show with out-of-town friends, let them know they can stream it live at theradiator.org every Monday from 2 to 3. Archived episodes of Write the Book are also available on iTunes and at writethebook.podbean.com as free podcasts. You can visit Write the Book on Twitter and Write the Book Radio Show on Facebook for updates. If you have a guest to suggest or comments about the show or news about book-related events, please send an email to writethebook@gmail.com. Do remember that The Radiator is here thanks to community support and involvement. More information about The Radiator is available online at theradiator.org. This has been Write the Book. I'm Shayla Shapiro, and you're listening to The Radiator, 105.9 FM, WOMM LP, Burlington, Vermont.